Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Next week marks the 500th anniversary of the first meeting between Spanish conquistador Hernando Cortes and Aztec Emperor Montezuma, the beginning of what would be an era lasting several centuries of colonialism, exploitation, and genocide in the Western world between Europeans and indigenous peoples. On this occasion, Gilcrease Museum and the Helmreich Center for American Research are hosting a one-day symposium with scholars from around the country tomorrow on rethinking colonialism in Mexico and the Americas. My guest will be one of the featured speakers tomorrow, who has led the cause for a re-examination of this first meeting and clash between European and indigenous civilizations. Matthew Restall is a professor of Latin American history and anthropology at Penn State University and the author of When Montezuma Met Cortez, The True Story of the Meeting That Changed History, which came out last year. This highly acclaimed history argues that the long-acknowledged accounts of this class of civilizations are wrong or wholly fabricated. Basically, everything we learned in history was not the case. Montezuma didn't surrender his throne. 400 Spaniards didn't conquer a million Aztecs in the course of a year or two. This is the victor's account, not the true account, according to Restall. He tells us what happened when Montezuma met Cortez today and tomorrow at Helmreich Center for American Research, and he's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Matthew Restall, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich. Nice to be here.
In your book, When Montezuma Met Cortez, you set out to correct what you call the myth history that has popularly become the actual history to the average person who knows anything about the Spanish conquest of this first major encounter between Europeans and the indigenous cultures of the West. And as you read the book, there's no shortage of myths that are regarded as facts in this meeting. We're now 500 years on. Why is it important to confront this myth history?
That's sort of the big question that underpins the book, right? Why, after 500 years, do we care about this? Isn't it been, you know, a very long time, and therefore these are events that can't possibly be connected to the modern world or to our lives today? And what I would suggest is that the 500-year anniversary just provides us with a really good opportunity to pause and think, is that really the case? And what I argue in the book is that this moment, this meeting, which happened 500 years ago as of this November the 8th, so we're just a week away from it, is the cornerstone of the changes that took place in the 16th, 17th, 18th century that led to the world that we live in today. That our entire world, our lives would not be possible the way they are if it weren't for a sequence of changes. It's true that many of those changes were in place before that, but that's true of any great moment in history, that there are things that happened prior to that that led to that moment. But I think this is kind of a turning point moment. The real twist in that tale, the thing that really makes it even more important as far as I'm concerned, is that the story that we've been told about that moment is, I think, completely wrong. And that story is to do with Montezuma, the emperor of the Aztecs, surrendering his empire to Cortes and his fellow Spanish conquistador captains, and therefore allegedly passing sovereignty of the empire over to the Spanish crown. And that has been taken as representing the acceptance on the part of Native America as a whole, I'm talking about the entire hemisphere, of some kind of march of progress and civilization, and the entire subsequent history of European colonization, globalization, and so on and so on, right, into big isms. That did not happen. He did not surrender. So what I try to do in this book is, first of all, persuade the reader that the surrender did not take place, that there's something else far more complicated going on, and then to explain why and how it is possible for a lie that massive to survive 500 years.
Well, as you write, this reinforced two separate streams, one of cultural superiority on the part of Europeans and a surmising by them that the indigenous peoples of the New World knew they were societally inferior.
Yes, exactly. That there's a kind of a assumption of a kind of a acquiescence or acceptance on their part. The idea that they are, they being indigenous peoples are so amazed and overwhelmed by, first of all, the technological superiority of Europeans, the material culture that they bring with them, their weapons and so on, and then struggling to understand the impact of other changes like disease and the degree to which they, indigenous people, suffer so much more than Europeans from these diseases. And then finally, the idea that they are convinced by the arguments of friars and priests to give up their indigenous religion, or from the European point of view, their superstitious ways, to put the devil behind them and accept the true faith. All of these are profoundly Eurocentric ideas that we would expect to find in the 16th century. The catch here and the problem is that the story, as it is not surprisingly set down in the 16th century, survives until the 21st century. We just don't realize that that's what it is. We don't see when we open up whatever it is, high school textbooks or a documentary on television or the text that accompanies a piece of public art. We don't realize that what we're reading is essentially the story that was written by conquistadors and friars in the 16th century in order to promote what they were doing.
And every culture has its myths, its founding myths, and this story of Spanish conquest has its similar myth. And what's really interesting is, as I was thinking, where do you start on this event? Because nearly the entire story that makes its way into the average history classroom here in America is seriously flawed or fabricated. You start with the fact that Montezuma didn't surrender, but there's also the story that he welcomed his conquerors for some religious portent, that he should give up the crown, or that a few hundred men defeated an empire of hundreds of thousands, mm-hmm. or that it happened very quickly. That was the other thing that was stuck in my brain, that, you know, Cortes came to what is now Mexico City, Tenochtitlan, and within a few weeks had conquered the empire. In fact, it took 3 or 4 years, and he had some serious allies, one of which was smallpox, to help him do that. So let's maybe start with that idea that a few hundred men could defeat an empire. And really, by the time they got to Montezuma's capital, they were in a ragtag bunch of men at this point, because they had been fighting the whole way there.
Yes, that's absolutely fundamental to the traditional story, and one sees that still over and over. I have a student who's investigating children's books and how this story is told in children's books. That's something that I talk about a little bit in the book, but there's enough material there for somebody to write an entire book just on that topic. And this student just this morning showed me a book written for young adults, published about 5 years ago. And we looked at the first three sentences, and almost every single word that wasn't, you know, the and in those sentences is a word that I wanted to put up on the blackboard and dismantle and pull to pieces and talk about how those words were perpetuating the same story that was being told by, for example, somebody called Francisco López de Gómara, who was paid by Cortés's son to write a book grossly and massively exaggerating the exploits of his father, Cortés, kind of a hagiography of Cortés, and to call the book The Conquest of Mexico. That's still the word, the phrase that we use to describe these events. And a lot of the events and spin and perspectives and tone of that book that was published originally in the 1550s underpins things like this book written for young adults right now in the 21st century. And right there at the beginning of it, is that what you just referred to, Rich? And the phrase is usually put something like, with just 400 men, Cortés managed to topple an empire of millions in a matter of a couple of years. So when we start to pull that apart, of course, we find it's much more complicated. The starting point to pulling it apart is to say, let's count how many Spaniards, if we can, actually participated in that war of invasion. And I did that in the course of doing the research for this book. I was actually amazed that no one else had done it quite in the same way. There were other historians, of course, going back through the decades who had pointed out that they weren't really 400 or 450 men, that others were coming during the course of the war. But I couldn't find anybody had actually systematically tried to count all the voyages and how many were on those voyages and so on. So the number I came up with, which is an approximate number, is 3,000. So that's in the course of the two-year war, 3,000 Spaniards come across, mostly from Cuba, some from Spain, but mostly from Cuba, to Mexico to participate in the war, not 400. However, just saying that is very misleading because that gives the impression that, oh, okay, well, there were still millions of Aztecs.
Right.
That's still impressive, right? 3,000. But in fact, most of the time it was less than that. So that first group of 450 within a matter of months are reduced to about half that number because the mortality rate is very high. So of that 3,000 who come over, two-thirds of them die during the course of the war. So at any one time, there's never more than 1,000. At the absolute peak point, there are 1,000 Spaniards there. And there are many moments when the number is between 200 and 250. So immediately the numbers kind of collapse. But the next thing we have to ask is, okay, so doesn't matter really. Does it matter if it's 200 or 3,000? Isn't that still impressive that they're able to topple an empire of millions in a few years? Then we have to then attack the empire of millions, right? And it's not them doing the fighting. That whenever there's military encounters or even diplomatic ones, like the one that takes place on November the 8th, 500 years ago, the Spaniards are outnumbered by thousands, if not tens of thousands, of indigenous people, men at arms, porters, support personnel, including families and so on. And that then changes our perspective on all of the events, on the sort of the cast of characters. If we were to go back in time in order to witness what happens on November the 8th, I think the first thing we would be struck by, well, the first thing would be how beautiful the Valley of Mexico was when Tenochtitlan was a city on an island in the middle of the lake. But I think the next thing that would strike us is how few Spaniards there were relative to all of the indigenous people, tens of thousands of indigenous people all around, and then just this tiny group of Spaniards. And that means that we constantly have to battle against this idea that, oh, yes, there you are, back to another tiny group of Spaniards. Look what they were able to do. Then let's follow the events and see what happens, the diplomatic wranglings, the military encounters, the shifting alliances, and so on. And I think then what we would start to see is that those Spaniards, so few in number, really play a relatively insignificant role in the decisions that are made, in the outcomes of military encounters, and so on. And the last part of that is, oh, they'd topple the empire in a couple of years. I can talk about that for a long time, but let me just say one very short thing. The conquest, we want to call it the conquest of Mexico, the conquest of Mesoamerica, doesn't end in 1521 when Tenochtitlan, the Aztec capital city, falls. That's when it begins. That's the beginning of that process, not the end of it.
And what I gathered from the book was that we think of Aztec culture like we do any federal culture today, and that is a wrong way to think about it. It was a series of alliances, city-states, that had recognized one another and recognized a ruler, but they all had their own interest, and that was something the Spanish certainly played up.
Yes. Identity in the Aztec Empire and in the larger area, in the area that scholars call Mesoamerica, basically Mexico and Central America, identity is highly localized. And indigenous people do not think of themselves as being a race in contrast with the Spaniards as another race. So the first thing we have to do is try not to see things the way we inevitably do from the modern period or through the eyes of Spaniards, and to understand that indigenous peoples see other peoples closer to how we would imagine ethnic groups. So a group of people from another part of Mesoamerica who might look a little different or might not, but would speak different languages, would be in a category of other, just as the Spaniards are, and just as the African slaves and servants that they bring with them are as well. And that determines how people then respond to the changes that are happening, to the invasion forces. And they respond in terms of the interest of their community and what is the best thing for their community. And for us to expect they're going to somehow have some larger understanding of what would be best for all indigenous peoples doesn't make any sense at all. And the other thing we have to remember is that they don't know what's going to happen. It's not reasonable for us to expect that any indigenous peoples are going to know or possibly anticipate that by accommodating small numbers of Spaniards, they're somehow opening a door to hundreds of years of colonization and neo-colonization and the advent of globalization and so on. No, they couldn't possibly have understood that. And even if they had, how is that going to change what they did? They're making decisions based on what is right for their local community. And I want to emphasize that rather than emphasize Spaniards taking advantage of differences. I think the traditional narrative has Cortes and the other Spaniards cleverly, cunningly seeing the divisions within the Aztec Empire and exploiting them. And the way the Spaniards present that is, oh, subjects of the empire chafed under the burden of Aztec rule because it was harsh and tyrannical, and so therefore we liberated them. So I think it's important to turn that around and say, no, they weren't chafing under the harshness of Aztec rule. They were making decisions for their communities based on what seems to be best for them, whether that is to agree to pay tribute to Tenochtitlan or not, whether to accommodate the Spaniards and allow the Spaniards to participate in a shifting of the balance of power within the valley or not. So the initiative is within these individual indigenous communities rather than the Spaniards cleverly exploiting divisions.
My guest today is Matthew Restall. He's a professor of Latin American history and anthropology at Penn State University. His most recent book is titled When Montezuma Met Cortez, The True Story of the Meeting That Changed History. He'll be a leading scholar speaking at the Helmreich Center for American Research's symposium, Rethinking Colonialism in Mexico and the Americas, which takes place Friday at the Helmreich Center at the Gilcrease. In the book, you write the story of the meeting is really one in which Montezuma does welcome the Spaniards to Tenochtitlan, and he welcomed them as a collector would welcome a zoo pet. In many ways, he had an extensive zoo. Tenochtitlan was a beautiful, beautiful city. He had an extensive zoo in which he collected all sorts of species of flora and fauna. And your idea is that he wanted to collect these Spaniards in the same way, so he welcomed them. Why didn't he just wipe the Spaniards out? This is a question that I think most people would have. They were certainly unsettling all of Mesoamerica. Why did he welcome them?
I think he's tempted by that idea, and there is indications that some of his advisors and some of the nobles and members of the royal family within that ruling circle are advising that. And I think that as he observes them from the moment they land on the coast, all the way back to the previous April, he is not bothered at all by the gradual decline in number. In fact, I suggest that the march from the coast into the Tlaxcalan area and the subsequent battles with the Tlaxcalans, which kills a number of the Spaniards, is really engineered by Montezuma and by the Aztecs using the Totonacs, who are loyal tribute-paying subjects of the Aztec Empire. So I think his idea is to study them before they get to the city, study them over those months, observe them, test them. If they are reduced in number as a result of military encounter, that's fine, as long as that makes them less threatening, and as long as there are still some alive that he can meet and talk to and study and so on. So I think when he welcomes them into the city, the question is still there on the lips of his advisors. Aren't there too many of them? I mean, do you really need, hundreds to study? And is it really a wise idea to allow them to leave the city and then to come back again? As they do, there's a certain amount of to-ing and fro-ing. But he's just too fascinated by them. He has a collection. He is the heir to an Aztec tradition, possibly a tradition that goes back long before the Aztecs, in fact, in the area whereby the ruler has living or non-living representations of everything that is in his empire. So that means live animals, fish, insects, birds, even human beings with deformities, objects that represent all parts of the empire, fossils and featherwork and found objects, man-made objects, everything you can think of, all of which represents everything that was within his empire. The Spaniards are now within his empire. They have arrived on its coast in April, and they are part of his domain, and he can't just let them be and allow them to wander around. He has to slowly lure them into the center so he can control them and watch over them and study them and understand where they come from and why it is that he did not know about them before, though I'm pretty sure, and I mentioned this in the book, there's evidence that the Aztecs have been tracking the Spaniards for years in terms of watching their ships sailing up and down and receiving information at the moments of when they've landed on the coast of Yucatan, for example. He understandably wants to know more about them. Now, as the months go by, from November until things really start to fall apart in May and June in the city, why does he not give in to the advice that I'm imagining he's receiving, that, okay, now's the time to get rid of them? That we can't know. It's hard to know exactly what was going on in his mind. I suspect that he just is too fascinated by watching these kind of events unfold and learning more and more about them and seeing how they respond to the arrival of more Spaniards on the coast, right? They go down there and there's a battle, the Spaniards fighting against each other, and then bringing more back into the city. There's evidence that Montezuma orders some Spaniards who are left on the coast and in other parts of the empire to be killed. He doesn't need them. They're not part of his collection. They possibly can cause trouble. So my argument that he does not surrender, that he's not a captive of the Spaniards, but it's the other way around, that they're sort of part of his collection, I think is pretty convincing. I hope it's entertaining to read. People seem fairly persuaded.
Yeah.
But does it kind of wrap everything up in a bow? No. Does it leave the door open for further debate and study and pushback and so on? Oh, yes, absolutely. And that's part of the fun of it. That's part of what makes it so fascinating, is it's not closed. I'm not trying to claim I've closed off the subject by solving all the riddles. If anything, I've kind of prompted, new riddles to be solved and discussed.
But it's interesting that he doesn't ever see them as a threat, which is a fundamental miscalculation, isn't it?
Yes. There's some phrases that I use when I'm giving presentations on the topic that I think are a little bit too rhetorical or polemical to actually have in print in the book, along the lines of, Montezuma miscalculates the degree to which he can tame the Spaniards. They're like lions and tigers. You can put them in a cage, but you can't tame them, and eventually they're going to rise up against their zookeeper and murder him. Having said that, you can probably see why I didn't put that in print. It's too easy, can be misinterpreted. Yes, I think there's some miscalculation there, and quite what goes on in May and June isn't clear. At some point, Montezuma and the other leaders, the surviving Tlatoani, or the king of the other two city-states in that alliance, are detained and imprisoned in the palace, and then they're murdered by the Spaniards. So I don't know exactly when that happens. I'm convinced it does not only not happen in November or December, but doesn't happen until the spring. But because the Spaniards insist that Montezuma was a captive since the end of the previous year, and almost everybody who was there dies subsequently, and those who survive, most of them claim that they were the personal guard of the emperor. And then they claim rewards as a result of that. Because of all of those things, it's hard to know exactly when it happened. But that might be the key to answering your question. By the time Montezuma realized that these guys were too dangerous, the situation was no longer under his control.
Well, I was really struck by the beginning of the book where you talk about the cultural underpinnings of this myth history, the cultural justification for the Spanish taking over Mesoamerica. It paves the way for every act of colonialism in the New World moving forward. This idea that the indigenous peoples of the West needed European intervention. This comes out of this episode, doesn't it?
It does. And I think that's why the lie of Montezuma's surrender has survived for so long and why it's so readily embraced by all the European powers and then their descendants, meaning, you know, the United States, for example, who are engaging in imperial activity for the next 500 years, because it acts as a justificatory metaphor. How do you defend that? How do you justify naked acts of aggression in order to expand empires that end up encompassing the globe? Well, there are various ways. You know, religion is one, for example. But how about a way that survives ideological shifts, survives all the way through a period from when religious justifications hold to when technological ones do, to when racial ones do? One simple story that survives all of those, that is very easy to tell, that everybody can grasp as a kind of a metaphor for whatever they have been doing or their ancestors or their nation, and that is, oh, surrender. Why did he surrender? He surrendered because he believed that was the destiny of those people, that it had been ordained, it had been prophesied that their true rulers would come across the ocean, and that his role therefore was to surrender and accept everything that came with that in terms of civilization, whether we think of that again in religious terms as the true faith, or we think of it just in larger terms. So it was, you know, bringing what is supposed to be a better way of life. I'm not saying this as sort of a conspiracy, right, of millions of people saying, oh yes, let's perpetuate this lie because it makes us feel better. But it does work beautifully, century after century, all over the world in different imperial cultures and systems as a metaphor. I think in the 21st century, it's you know, it's time to interrogate all of this stuff and unpack it and see how we can better understand what happened, not just in the 16th century, but the last 500 years, and perhaps try to ensure that history does not repeat itself.
That will be the subject for the symposium Rethinking Colonialism in Mexico and the Americas this Friday. Matthew Restall, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Matthew Restall is a professor of Latin American history and anthropology at Penn State University and the author of When Montezuma Met Cortez, The True Story of the Meeting That Changed History. He'll be a leading scholar speaking at the Helmrich Center for American Research's symposium, Rethinking Colonialism in Mexico and the Americas, taking place tomorrow at the Helmrich Center for American Research on the campus of Gilcrease. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.